This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Republican supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump are planning a vigorous defense of him as public congressional impeachment hearings start Wednesday that target his presidency. Trump administration officials are bracing for hours of testimony from two U.S. Department officials. The AP's Rita Foley reports.
Bill Taylor, the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, has said what he found when he was sent to Kiev was alarming. An irregular channel of U.S. policymaking outside the official channel, run by, among others, President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Career Foreign Service Officer George Kent has previously testified that President Trump wanted to hear three words from Ukraine's president: investigations, Biden, and Clinton. On Friday, Marie Yovanovitch testifies, seen as a tough U.S. ambassador but recalled by President Trump during the time the U.S. was trying to root out corruption in Kiev. Rita Foley, Washington.
A cool change in the weather is bringing some relief for firefighters battling massive brush fires in eastern Australia, which destroyed 50 homes already. Still, the New South Wales Rural Fire Service Commissioner, Shane Fitzsimmons, says the threat of more fires still exists.
So we've now got 17 fires at the Watch and Act alert level, which is indicative of dynamic situation still, and subject to the weather today, we could see some volatility and some change of that alert level across different fire grounds.
The commissioner said as of Tuesday, there were no life-threatening injuries reported, and they have no reports of people missing, with dozens of fires still burning. For details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com or on the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan visits Washington this week to meet with President Trump. Charles de Ledesma has more on the story.
Turkey's president says Syrian Kurdish fighters have failed to vacate areas along the Turkish border, despite agreements with Russia and the U.S., and says he'll talk with President Donald Trump on it. Speaking before departing for Washington, Erdogan said he would also give Trump documents listing terror attacks allegedly carried out by Mazlum Abdi, the commander of the U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish-led force. Turkey wants U.S. officials to arrest Abdi. Ankara believes the U.S. nor Russia have been able to clear northern Syria of terrorist organizations within the time they promised. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The Army's use of the TikTok app raising question of other concerns on Capitol Hill here in Washington. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has more on that story.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is voicing concerns about the Army's use of a China-owned video app called TikTok. The Army's using the app as part of a new recruiting campaign. In a letter to Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy, Schumer points out that national security experts have raised concerns about TikTok's collection and handling of user data, including personal information. Schumer also notes that Chinese laws compel companies to cooperate with China's government and intelligence collection. A spokeswoman for the Army Secretary says the Army is aware of concerns about TikTok. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter is recovering after undergoing a procedure to relieve pressure on his brain from bleeding linked to recent falls. The Carter Center, a nonprofit founded by Carter, announced on Twitter that there are no complications from the surgery. The 95-year-old Carter is the longest-living president in U.S. history. A car bomb exploded outside the government offices in the Afghan capital of Kabul Wednesday, killing seven people. Officials say seven others were wounded in the bombing near the Interior Ministry headquarters. So far, there has been no claim of responsibility for the attack, which came a day after the Afghan government released three high-ranking Taliban leaders in exchange for an American and Australian who have been held hostage by the Islamic insurgent group since 2016. Australia's highest court agreed Wednesday to hear an appeal from the most senior Catholic to be found guilty of sexually abusing children, giving Cardinal George Pell his last chance at getting his convictions overturned. Nearly a year ago, a jury found Pope Francis' former finance minister guilty of molesting two 13-year-old boys after he became Archbishop of Australia's second largest city. The 78-year-old was sentenced to 6 years in prison back in March. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon's so-called restoration forces deny targeting the clergy.
Quite a number of priests have been killed, including an American missionary. And in all cases, it was established that Cameroon government forces targeted these priests and killed them.
A Kenyan court acquits three South Sudanese activists accused of allegedly plotting to overthrow President Salva Kiir. Kenya hosts an international conference on population and development. Why are some civil society or education coalition members leaving Malawi? And the WHO welcomes the approval of a new Ebola vaccine.
This will speed up any further process for having more quantity of the vaccine whenever we need it in order to vaccinate healthcare workers and first-line responders to have them ready for the battle against Ebola.
Christian Limaya is the WHO spokesperson, and in Zimbabwe, the sick get sicker as the stalemate between striking doctors and the government continues. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for Cameroon's self-proclaimed Ambazonia Republic interim government says his group has not targeted the clergy in their fight against the Cameroon military. On the contrary, Chris Anu says the Cameroon military has targeted and killed Roman Catholic priests. The denial followed a call by Bishop Andrew Unkea for separatist fighters to stop targeting and harassing local clergy. Bishop Unkea says he has documented several incidents in his diocese where some unknown gunmen claiming to be members of the so-called Restoration Forces of Ambazonia have targeted the clergy. But Chris Anu says anyone involved in kidnapping and ransom taking does not fight for the Restoration Forces.
First, James, let me say that there is nothing called separatists. Anybody who refers to Ambazonians as separatists are apologists to French Cameroon. I guess the bishop wants to say restorationists are targeting the priests, but I would love to ask or pose the question back to him. For what reason would the restorationists attack the priests? In the course of this conflict in Cameroon, quite a number of priests have been killed, including an American missionary, and in all cases, it was established that Cameroon government forces targeted these priests and killed them. There is no one example in Ambazonia where restoration forces have targeted the priests and killed them.
Yet, Chris, the bishop has documented a number of incidents where clergy or priests have been kidnapped in the region. He concludes that only the Amba boys are responsible.
The restoration movement in which I belong and which this interim government leads has nothing called Amba Boys. Rather, we have Ambazonia Restoration Forces. People like Paul Atanganji, the government minister, they run these rogue groups that the general public like to refer to as Amba Boys. And cronies to the regime in Cameroon, like the late mayor of Boya, they also operated groups called Amba Boys. You have these Amba Boys, both in the northern and the southern zones of Ambazonia, and they have been carrying out some of these things. If any kidnappings have taken place, or not just the priests, but even the regular person on the street, these things have been carried out mostly by some of these Amba Boys. James, we interest you yesterday. I did a special broadcast for over 2 hours, basically indicting all the kidnappings and the ransom takings that have been going on in Ambazonia. And we made it very clear, categorically clear, anybody who indulges in kidnapping and ransom taking does not fight for Ambazonia, does not belong to Ambazonia Revolution.
A peace forum is taking place in Paris, France, sponsored by President Macron. I read an article just a while ago where many human rights organizations are calling on President Macron to get involved in the Cameroon situation to stop the fighting there. Would you welcome France's involvement?
we always welcome everyone with good intentions to bring the two parties, French Cameroon and the Southern Cameroon's Ambazonia, to table to negotiate. There is already an ongoing peace process initiated by the Swiss government. We want to hope that if the French are interested in a negotiated settlement that ends this conflict, they should join the Swiss government as maybe observers or facilitators. The Swiss process has been endorsed by the USA, the United Nations, the AU, the Commonwealth, and Canada. Of course, the United Kingdom.
Chris, thank you as usual. It's so nice to talk with you.
My pleasure, sir.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed interim government of Ambazonia. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston. A court in Kenya has thrown out a case against three South Sudanese activists who were accused by the Kenyan government of unlawful assembly and an alleged coup plot against President Salva Kiir. The young men were arrested after they staged an anti-Kiir protest at the South Sudanese embassy in Nairobi in July this year. Paul Ogandi is a lawyer representing the three men. He says the case was thrown out of court because the Kenyan government could not produce evidence showing the young men were planning to topple President Kiir.
The official charges were unlawful assembly, and of course there were those allegations which were not formally brought before the court.
And what were those allegations that were not brought formally before the court?
Well, I understand the embassy were accusing some of the accused persons of trying to overthrow the government and creating instability.
From your legal perspective, how is the case proceeding?
Well, we've been attending court since June, July, and for the better part, we've gone there five times. The government could not produce witnesses to support their case, the government of Kenya. You see, criminal proceedings are brought in the name of the government of Kenya because it's in Kenya we are handling this case. So we had given them time to prepare their prosecution, and they were not able to pull through or to put together a case.
It's my understanding that this youth who had gone out to demonstrate or protest had a police permit for their protest, correct?
What I saw from the documents provided was a letter, a notification. We do not issue permits as a right because the right to assembly is our human right here in Kenya. So what usually is required is that you notify the police, and if they have any problem, they can ask you not to take part in the assembly or to proceed with it.
As we speak now, there's no case against this youth in court in Kenya.
As we speak now, the case has been withdrawn under Section 87 of the Criminal Procedure Code, and they will be coming back if they get evidence. They will charge them afresh.
Meaning the government of Kenya will charge the youth afresh if there's any tangible evidence that they were trying to overthrow the government of South Sudan?
If they have any other credible, tangible evidence, they can profile any charges, including assembly, which was unlawful assembly, or any other crime they might prefer.
How did it all start, where the Kenyan government is accusing the youth? I thought it was the South Sudan embassy that complained, and then the case was brought forward.
I think it all started during the Independence Day for South Sudan, and a number of South Sudanese refugees in Kenya had an event next to their embassy. I'm not sure who made the report, but some of them were arrested in that context, including the three. I think the three were arrested in that context, and that is how I got involved.
Paul Ogandi is the lawyer representing three South Sudanese activists. He spoke with Sir John Tanza from Nairobi, Kenya. Today is Wednesday, November 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Kenya is hosting a United Nations coordinated conference on population and development this week in Nairobi. Over 6,000 delegates from 160 nations, including heads of state, are attending the three-day forum to discuss reproductive health rights, ending gender-based violence, and sustainable development. Rayel Ombuor reports from Nairobi.
The UN's International Conference on Population and Development opened Tuesday with repeated vows made at the first summit in Cairo 25 years ago. Crown Princess Mary of Denmark, a co-host of the conference, underscored the significance of the summit.
I think we can all agree that ICBD was a turning point, a defining moment in our history. In Cairo, the world articulated a bold new vision about the relationship between population, development, and individual well-being, and the empowering of women and meeting people's needs for education and health, including sexual and reproductive health, are necessary for both individual advancement and balanced development.
The summit aims to examine the progress made since a 1994 program of action drafted in Cairo. More than 150 countries signed on to the plan, which placed women's empowerment, individual dignity and human rights, and the right to plan one's family at the heart of development. In Nairobi Tuesday, heads of state stressed their country's policies and commitments to gender equality, sexual and reproductive health. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta pledged to end female genital mutilation by 2022. Kenyatta was among African leaders who called also for ending child marriage.
I believe that we can all commit to eliminate child marriages. The percentage of young women between 20 and 24 years of age who are married before their 18th birthday has declined from 34% in 1994 to 25% in 2019. But the absolute number of girls under 18 who are at risk of child marriages is estimated at 10.3 million in 2019.
Child marriage and sexual and reproductive health care are controversial issues in African nations where traditional cultures often clash with campaigns for individual rights. In some countries like Kenya, laws that limit access to abortion services have fueled unsafe, often deadly backstreet abortions. At the conference Tuesday, the UN's Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed tied women's rights squarely to development.
The power to choose the number, timing and spacing of children is a human right that can bolster well-being, economic and social development. And when people can exercise their rights, they thrive, and they do, and so do societies at large.
To reach those goals, the Nairobi Conference on Population and Development is expected to produce pledges of financial support. But it will take more than money and talk to see some African nations enforce laws and regulations on gender equality and sexual and reproductive health. Ryle Lombard for VOA News, Nairobi.
This week, the European Commission gave approval to an Ebola vaccine, an act that World Health Organization calls a landmark movement for global health and a likely game changer in the battle against the deadly disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
This is the first time an Ebola vaccine has been licensed anywhere in the world. The next step, pre-qualification by the World Health Organization, is expected within days. Pre-qualification means WHO is satisfied with the vaccine's quality, safety, and effectiveness. WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer tells VOA this is an important step and a great achievement for public health.
This will speed up any further process of getting a vaccine into a country for licensing, for manufacturing, for having more quantity of the vaccine whenever we need it, or ahead of a presumed outbreak in order to vaccinate healthcare workers and first-line responders to have them ready for the battle against Ebola.
The vaccine, in its experimental stage, has been and continues to be used in the ongoing Ebola epidemic in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. It has been used to protect more than 250,000 people in the DRC's Ituri and North Kivu provinces. Lindemeyer says WHO has developed a roadmap aimed at accelerating pre-qualification and licensing of the vaccine. This will enable the agency to quickly roll out the vaccine in high-risk countries in Africa.
What does this mean right now for the Democratic Republic of Congo? Right now, nothing will change because the vaccines, as they are available, will be used. Right now, this doesn't change anything for the moment. Vaccines are already available. Vaccines are already been used. It's the same vaccine, which is highly efficacious. But it's an absolutely great news to see that this has now been approved and will be pre-qualified.
Lindemeyer says there likely will be a higher demand for Ebola vaccine in coming years. He says WHO is working with Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, the United Nations Children's Fund, and other partners to develop a global Ebola vaccine security plan to fulfill growing needs and to ensure vaccine security. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Civil Society Education Coalition of Malawi says at least 20 member organizations of the coalition are closing due to lack of funds. Executive Director Benedictu Kondowe says he fears this trend could set the development of Malawi's poor public education sector back well, because NGOs play a major role in helping the government's education agenda. Kondowe says the donor community should continue supporting non-governmental organizations.
Basically, what we're saying as a network during our annual general assembly was a way of reflecting the good work that the NGO is doing in Malawi, especially in the education sector, appreciating the fact that the challenges that Malawi is faced with are quite complex, to the extent that government on its own would hardly be able to address all those issues. And on that basis, the different interventions by the NGOs in the sector have helped to deal with some of those issues. However, the funding environment in Malawi has become very, very difficult, in that most NGOs are not accessing funding, to the extent that including in the trans sector, a number of NGOs are purely operating on paper, because that's what gives them the legal personality to exist. But operationally, they are not. In some cases, you have a situation where an NGO can't even pay salaries for their own staff. We have also witnessed the retrenchment, downsizing by the NGOs in terms of reducing the number of employees employed, because they do not have the capacity to keep them employed and they paid for. So all we're saying is that this challenge is quite big, and therefore, as a network, we're essentially appealing to government and development partners in Malawi that perhaps this is an issue that needs more thinking, so that we can actually save some of these NGOs.
In most African countries, the national governments are largely responsible for education. How much impact and what role specifically do these NGOs play in the education system of Malawi? And what would likely be the impact as they are leaving?
The impact would be quite huge, because we have a significant number of NGOs that are in the construction of infrastructure, be it teacher houses, additional classrooms, and many more infrastructure. We also have some NGOs that are in service delivery. So they are actually training teachers and so forth. And if you look at the context of Malawi, you'll appreciate that the non-state actors play a very crucial role in the production of teachers. Institutions like Development Aid from People to People, who are running teacher training colleges. Then we also have faith-based institutions, the Catholics through the Montfort College and other entities. So all we are saying is that they are playing a very, very important role. And you must also appreciate that since 2010-2011, donors pulled direct budget support due to issues of corruption. And until now, they have not resumed that. And the commitment then was that donors will continue to support Malawi, but through NGOs. So all we are saying is that with the dwindling funds in the country, it will essentially create a huge gap, to the extent that the right to education will not be guaranteed.
Benedicto Kondowe is the executive director of the Civil Society Education Coalition of Malawi. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. In Zimbabwe, the sick are getting sicker without scant treatment as government continues to fire doctors who have been on strike since September. Rutendo Mawere reports from Harare.
As the government dismisses doctors who claim runaway inflation has left them too incapacitated to go to work, the poor are suffering even more. Most public hospitals are in emergency mode, attending only to those in mortal danger. This has left the poor and ill stranded, as they cannot afford the private doctor fees. a 46-year-old woman who asked only to be identified as Mamoyo has cancer in her private parts. She is awaiting an operation before she can start chemotherapy. In pain and fearing the cancer is spreading, Mamoyo is not getting any help from the hospital because of the embassy between public doctors and the government that began on September
3.
Mamoyo says she was supposed to undergo surgery in August, but the procedure has been postponed 3 times. Last week, she traveled from Chiredzi to Parenyatwa Hospital, where she saw a general practitioner and was advised to come back when the doctor's strike is over. She shows a card she was given that says there are no surgeons at the moment. She says she worries there's no hope that government will solve the problem. The government fired 77 doctors early last week for absenteeism, then 134 on Friday, and says it will dismiss more after disciplinary hearings. Mamoyo says she fears the strike could stretch into the new year. Mamoyo says surviving on expensive painkillers while waiting for surgery is draining her. She says she can no longer afford the drugs she needs and says the operation is her only hope. The doctors have accused the government of being inhumane, given that the health system already was short on drugs and equipment. Acting treasurer for the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association, Dr. Peter Mungova, says that it is the ordinary people that government is punishing.
Ordinary citizens are suffering. The most vulnerable, the children and the elderly, the pregnant women, they are suffering in various areas of this country. And this is what they decide to do in order to solve the situation.
Dr. Paulina Skosana of HSP said government had tasked the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Health, Dr. Agnes Maomva, to come up with ways to ensure continuity of service, but there has been no feedback. Maomva was not immediately available for comment. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A spokesman for Cameroon's self-proclaimed Ambazonia Republic interim government says his group has not targeted the clergy in their fight against the Cameroon military. On the contrary, Chris Anu says the Cameroon military has targeted and killed Roman Catholic priests. The denial followed a call by Bishop Andrew Nkeya for separatist fighters to stop targeting and harassing local clergy. Bishop Nkeya says in a pastoral letter that he has documented several incidents in his diocese where some unknown gunmen claiming to be members of the so-called Restoration Forces of Amazonia have targeted the clergy. But Chris Anu says anyone involved in kidnapping and ransom taking does not fight for the Restoration Forces. A court in Kenya has thrown out a case against 3 South Sudanese activists who were accused by the Kenyan government of unlawful assembly and an alleged coup plot against President Salva Kiir. The young men were arrested after they staged an anti-Kiir protest at the South Sudanese embassy in Nairobi in July of this year. Paul Ngenda, the lawyer representing the 3, says the case was thrown out of the court because the Kenyan government could not produce evidence showing the young men were planning to topple President Kiir. And that is it for this Wednesday, November 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Thank you.